Hi guys, this is Josh.
This is Jen.
And this is From Cloud to Cab. Today we have with us Ken Staver. He's the acting director for the Y Research and Education Center in Queenstown. And he's also associate research scientist with the University of Maryland Extension.
Or just just for the College of Ag and Natural Resources.
Okay, great. So, Ken, how long have you been with the college?
I've been with the college for about 34 years.
34 years.
Here at this site, here at the Y.
You've been at the Y the whole time?
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the types of things you've worked on in that time?
Well, I'd say in the early 80s, we really started, before we knew all the things we know now, really the first part of the effort was really just sort out how water and nutrients move around in ag systems, the typical ag systems in Maryland Eastern Shore. So really just trying to pick the systems apart and figure out how they work.
Hmm.
And that was sort of the starting point for solving the sort of trying to reduce some of the nutrient losses. So the early stages were just doing the foundation work to really know how these systems work.
How did that topic initially come up? Sort of restoring water quality around the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, in the 70s, you know, the concerns about the degraded water quality in the 70s came up. So, of course, you start looking at a water body, you look at problems. Well, what that leads you to look at is the land that drains to the water. So you look at the land use in this part of the world, especially on the Eastern Shore. It's primarily agricultural. There are not that many people, very concentrated agriculture. So you start looking at the nutrient loads, and you're just basically looking at the nutrient loads to the bay and saying, well, the majority of the loads are in this part of the world are coming from the cropland. So the pressure started to mount early on that if we were going to restore Chesapeake Bay, especially on the Eastern Shore side, a big part of the reductions were going to have to come from cropland. Mm-hmm. So the pressure started to build on agriculture to figure out ways to reduce nutrient losses.
Yeah.
And of course, as the ag college, I mean, back then it was the College of Agriculture and not the College of Agricultural and Natural Resources. Certainly from the agricultural side, the goal is to maintain productivity and economic viability of agriculture.
Mm.
So the simplistic things like, oh, we'll just reforest the watershed. Well, that would work for the Bay, but it doesn't work for the agricultural community or the rural economy.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of trying to find a solution that, keeps everybody going.
Sure, it's a tightrope.
It's a tightrope.
So what were some solutions identified then?
Well, the history of water quality research in agriculture had really focused on soil erosion. Essentially, since the beginning of time, agriculture was mostly tillage-based. So you were always turning over the soil. You're making it vulnerable to erosion. I think the whole, you know, of course, this area has been farmed for literally hundreds of years. This was some of the first land that was settled, was plowed. Wheat and corn production goes back hundreds of years. It's not a new thing. I mean, there's a lot of concern about corn production and the high, you know, when the ethanol came online, everybody said, oh, we're growing all this corn. Well, in fact, if you look at Maryland, more corn was grown in 1900 than we grow now. So it was all tilled, and all that ground was tilled every year with horses, amazingly, with horses. But you can imagine the erosion when all that land was plowed year after year after year. So the original concern on water quality and agricultural pollution goes back to the Dust Bowl. When the Dust Bowl hit here in this country in the back in the 30s, and it's loss of this degradation of cropland, but also damage into down gradient water bodies from all this erosion. So when we started the Bay effort, what everybody was focused on was the traditional things, which was soil erosion. But we quickly figured out that the dissolved nutrients were really the bigger part of the problem. So that was a whole new, that opened up a whole new set of problems that we had to deal with. And really one of the things, the big things that came out for us in the 80s was that most of the nitrogen leaving our coastal plain agricultural systems was actually going into shallow groundwater and reaching the surface water. So into shallow groundwater, into streams, or actually discharging around the shorelines as most of the nitrogen was going as nitrate in the shallow groundwater system. So it wasn't a surface erosion problem at all. So all these things we do to control surface erosion, which was sort of what was in the toolbox at that time, really wasn't effective really wasn't effective on the main route of nitrogen loss from the system. Mm-hmm.
Jen, didn't you, you wanted to breach a couple topics here?
I did. And I just, you know, I wanted to start out with the idea that, you know, the 30 years of research in this area, right? You know, you had a quote where you gave a presentation a couple weeks ago or in the middle of August at the 4R field day, and you talked about how after 30 years you really start to have an understanding of what's happening and how things move and things like that. And so I just wanted to, you started talking about what initial research looked like. Can you describe kind of the path that's taken since the early 80s and where your research is evident in some of the bay restoration effort? Like, how has it affected what we do with that?
Right. Well, so the first step is sort of characterize the problem and then what are some options for solving it. And I think on the groundwater nitrogen side, which is probably the biggest thing that I think was different from what people were thinking about a solution. It was, no, what we're thinking we need to do something else. And it really became clear, even in the early on, the first 5 years, when we were doing water budgets, and on these fields, we were measuring everything leaving these fields on a 24/7, 365. And we were monitoring these fields year-round, looking when water was moving, when nutrients were moving. And it was clear that we had to stop some of the nitrate that we were losing in the wintertime, in the late fall and winter. So we started working with these winter cereal cover crops, which have been around for eons. I think, you know, since the first words were ever written about agriculture, cover crops were mentioned. And historically, it was for maintaining fertility, because before we had the availability of chemical fertilizers and we had all these big mines to get nutrients into our ag systems and transport them, a farmer was always concerned about keeping the nutrients in the root zone. So you use cover crops for that. Well, in our case, it's a little different. We're trying to, we like the benefits of keeping the nutrients in the soil, but we really are after keeping that nitrate out of shallow groundwater. So we started doing the work, cover crops. As soon as we started collecting data, it was literally the first year we did it. In 87, we had our first pilot studies with cover crops. It was clear they were going to work for keeping nitrate out of groundwater. They were going to make a huge difference right away. It was clear. So then the process starts of how do you, so going on back to your question of how does this change what we do on a big watershed like Maryland's part or even the whole Chesapeake Bay. And now even the Mississippi, every watershed in the country is dealing with this, with the same, some version of the same issue. So we started working on cover crops and they got into what was called a tributary strategy. So every watershed in Maryland had a tributary strategy, and that was a plan to meet the nutrient reduction goals that were deemed necessary to restore the bay. And even in 1995, at that point, cover crops were listed as the primary tool to get the nitrogen reductions in the eastern short tribs. The problem was, it's one thing to set goals, it's another thing to actually get the cover crops on the land. Mm-hmm. And it did not happen. So then the goal shifts from science a little bit to policy and trying to get the cover crops implemented. And it's funny, the management community kept coming back to the scientists and saying, wasn't there another way? Because, you know, is there something else we can do other than cover crops? And we really just, from a standpoint of keeping the fields productive, there's just not other ways. We just did not have other answers to do. So we kept coming back to, well, you have to do cover crops. So then the question would become, well, what do we need to do to get farmers to plant more cover crops? And it's a cost that they can't recapture, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. So farmers really weren't so willing to do it just for the bay because they have their own financial realities to deal with. So we kept going back and forth. There were some pilot cost share programs in the early 90s where the farmers would be paid. If you don't understand cost share, it's basically where there's public money put in. A farmer's given something to offset the cost of a practice that's provides overall benefit, public benefit, environmental benefits in this case. So start with some pilot programs. Then they went away, and every time the money came in, the acres went up, and then when the money go away, the acres went down. And finally, we got went through 2000, and it was obvious we weren't meeting our nutrient reduction goals, so kept coming back to the scientific community and said, what do we do? We said, well, we need cover crops. We need cover crops. Like we said 10 years ago, we need more cover crops. So we got more public investment, and there were some major dedicated funding sources developed in the state of Maryland as a political process. Fortunately, we have an electorate and we had leadership that was that basically understood the economics of farming. An electorate was willing to, in some way, be agreeable to this, to helping to support this program. So we have really one of the largest funding sources for a water quality practice is the cover crop program in Maryland. So where farmers are compensated for the cost of planting cover crops. So we have them on the ground. So that's the step from defining the problem, setting goals for implementation, and then finding ways to get it done.
Sounds like it only took 20 years.
Yes. Yeah, we didn't really meet the goals. The implementation goals were not met for 20 years.
Yeah.
So it was a case of people say, well, things don't work. Well, part of the answer was, well, you got to do it.
Right.
Right. So it can work in theory, but if you don't actually do it, you don't get the result. And then on top of that, what makes it even more complicated is the groundwater travel times are long. So when you start planting cover crops, you don't get the benefit instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So we're testing the patience, everybody's patience right now, because you start doing something and you don't get the result, which is reduction in stream nitrate levels. You don't get that. We're talking decadal time frames there too. So you wait 20 years to... It takes you 10 years to figure out the problem, and it takes you 20 years to do what you need to do to fix it, and then it takes 20 years for the effect to show up. So this is testing the limits of patience of politicians and the public and so on. But it is moving in the right direction.
And so the research has been largely focused on the benefits to water quality with cover crops. And I know that there's a pretty concerted effort now to describe the benefits to soil health, to farm economics, to, you know, other aspects of the farming operation. And I wondered if you had seen anything in the research that you've done that can speak into that. You know, are there other benefits to farmers to planting cover crops? You said that there wasn't like a short-term economic benefit, but is there anything that you've observed about how that impacts like over the long term?
Right. Well, definitely, even in the short term, one of the things that happens, weather is a huge unknown in our farming systems. Most years, water availability will limit, especially corn yields, crop yields in this part of the world. Now, this year, we're in a year where too much water is a bit of a problem, but in a lot of years, water availability is a limiting factor. Limits crop yield, so it affects profitability. So cover crops, even in the short term, in a no-till system, you have residue cover, you have a little moisture conservation. So there are some benefits where you can recap some of your costs just because of saving a little moisture by having that extra residue cover, especially in our no-till systems, which Maryland, we're a big no-till state. So in a no-till system, you definitely conserve water. Also, I mean, you keep your soil temperatures a little cooler, you can reduce stress a little bit. So when you go into a drought period, you buy yourself a little time. So you can go 3 or 4 more days in a field that's no-tilled with a cover crop. You can last 3 or 4 more days before you really get the yield loss that you'll get in a field, especially a field that was tilled. But the cover crop residue helps conserve moisture. Now we got these challenges with these weeds that are getting more and more herbicide resistant. Cover crop residue helps with weed control, so you can cut herbicide costs a little bit. So there's ways. It's a higher management input from the farmer. So the farmer has to invest more time and just energy just into staying on top of things. But if they can do that, they can get some benefits. They can get some real dollar savings in the short term. Then in the long term, soil quality is a bit like chasing ghosts. It's there. We can sort of, well, maybe a ghost wasn't a good analogy, but But it's a long-term thing. There's benefits there. Again, a lot of it's weather dependent, when you see the benefits and when you don't. Okay. Whether you can manage, you know, if you really get on top. And one of the great things about the cost share programs, it gives farmers an opportunity to work with cover crops and learn how to manage them without being under so much financial pressure. So so we do feel like in the long term, I don't support saying, oh, well, the cost share program should end. I think it's an ongoing thing. I don't see any reason to end it. But should that happen, at least farmers have had the opportunity to learn how to work with cover crops. So the likelihood that they'll keep using them and see some of these benefits and figure out how to manage them is I think it helps. It helps there. So, but definitely some long-term benefits, but requires more management, and a lot of it's weather dependent. So,
have you seen any change in the soil organic matter on the farms here in the time that you've been working with them?
Well, the biggest effect on organic matter is going to no-till.
Okay.
So separating out the cover crop benefit from the no-till benefit is not so easy to do.
I see.
So the big thing is no-till. So then cover crops layered on top of no-till adds a little more, but it's a smaller signal. So it's harder to tease it out.
Okay.
So yes, we can increase organic matter. But no-till more than cover crops. You keep tilling, and you have cover crops. You won't get much out of that.
I see.
So no-till is the big one on organic matter.
In your research, you've mostly been working with small grains, right? Like rye, barley, wheat, things like that.
Right.
Have you seen anything? What can you tell us about different varieties?
Well. The way our situation here is we want to get as much growth and nitrate uptake in the fall as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the year, crop harvest can be late, especially after soybeans. So we're always looking at that window. We're always fighting the window of how much cover crop growth and nitrate uptake can we get before the cold temperatures hit and really shut things down. So so basically what you want is the cereal that grows when it's the coldest and so sort of keeps working in difficult conditions. And for us, rye really, and I think there's studies all around the country that have shown that year in, year out, it's hard to beat rye as a winter cover crop for nitrate scrubbing and residue production when you're working with that limited window that we have following corn and soybean harvest. Especially soybeans can really get to be challenging.
Right.
We have late soybean harvest. And it's tricky to get a, sometimes it's tricky to get a cover crop established after late harvested soybeans. Well, it's difficult, especially if it's a cold fall. Now, lately the trend has been milder falls, which makes cover crops work. Makes cover crops work even better, even when they're planted late. So,
what about trying to make an effort to plant cover crops earlier? Is that a big benefit, or is it better to focus on things that you can plant later on?
Well, early is always better if you have the window.
Okay.
Early is, in the cost share program, there's incentives. It's an incentive-based program to pay the most for the most effective use of cover crops. And by far, early planting has always been a top bonus. If you want the bonus payment, you plant early because that's how it works the best. But it is challenging, again, because if harvest is not early, then the only option for planting cover crop early is seeded over top. That's aerial seeding. That's out of a plane, or there are other ways to plant over top, over top the standing crop. So when I say over top, I'm talking about planting the cover crop seed while the crop is still growing in the field, or at least hasn't been harvested yet.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us wouldn't garden by going out and throwing the seed out, opening the packet and throwing it on top of the ground, right? Something will come up, right? You'll get a plant or two here and there. But if you want, we know that if we plant seed in the ground, we're going to have a more successful, stand. We're going to have more plants growing per square foot if we put the seed in the ground.
Okay.
So we're always balancing the less effective planting methods of aerial seeding against wanting to plant it early. So if we know we're going to have a tropical storm coming and we're going to get a couple days of rain, we can plant over top and have great cover crops.
Right.
We can drop a seed out of a plane, and if it's a dry spell and we don't get rain for 10 days, the seed just sits there for 10 days. And so you thought you gained, but you didn't gain anything because the seed didn't germinate. So it's a tricky business of the early planting. But definitely, as soon as the crop is harvested, you want to plant immediately. I mean, that's just one of those that's rule number one about timing. Cover crops and timing is huge. But for us, there's places in the country where they talk about these multi-species cover crops where they have longer windows. So, for instance, after we have wheat harvest here, we always plant soybeans after wheat. Mm. Whereas there's places in the country where when they harvest wheat, it's too late to plant soybeans, and they actually let the fields go fallow after wheat. So they have these options for planting all these different cover crop species that have a wide window. It's not a window wide enough for soybeans, but for a cover crop, it's a very wide window. Mm. We don't have ground that lays fallow here in late summer, almost never.
Okay.
So it's in some ways here we have options, but in other ways we have less options than some parts of the country. So.
Okay. I think I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about manure, poultry litter.
Oh, if great.
It's all right. Oh, great. I know. It's our favorite topic. But it's a really common nutrient source in this area, and I think it affects the recommendations for how you manage land. So just starting off is with manure or poultry litter as a nutrient source, you know, what can you tell us about using that? Like, what are some considerations with it? How is it different from using just an inorganic fertilizer?
Right. Well, first, I mean, it's a great nutrient source. I mean, it's the nutrient source before we had, you know, chemical fertilizer, other than the legumes fixing atmospheric nitrogen. But so it's a great nutrient source, and we grow, the corn is almost grown exclusively. I mean, most of the corn is grown for animal feed, and soybeans too. So really the cycle is to grow the grains and return the nutrients that come out of the animals back to the soil to continue the cycle. And even for us here in this part of the world with the huge number, the high population, the Chesapeake Bay watershed, I mean, the food, then just take the cycle a bit further, the food, well, maybe I shouldn't even bring this up, but the food goes to the reason we grow these grain is to grow the animals to feed the people, so then the nutrients come out of the people. So the whole full cycle is really coming all the way back from the people back to the land. So being here, being in this part of the world with all these population centers, we have a lot of nutrients trickling back from human populations too. So we have a lot of organic nutrient sources in this part of the world. So the difference between the inorganic nutrients and the organic nutrient sources is primarily you can be very prescriptive with inorganic nutrients. So fertilizers, commercial fertilizers, you can put them on at the exact amount you want. It's a much more concentrated product, so it's easier to apply. It's easier to apply below the soil surface. So there's commercial equipment available to subsurface apply nutrients, so you get them off the soil surface, which is a positive thing from an environmental quality. You can apply them after the crop is already growing, which is also a big advantage. You can apply commercial fertilizers through irrigation systems. You can drive over the field with high clearance vehicles and apply nitrogen on corn when the corn is 3 or 4 feet tall. Whereas all the organic sources, you have to apply them before the crop is planted. So you're in a situation where you've put a nutrient source out there well in advance of when the crop actually needs most of the nutrients. So from a standpoint of timing and precision, it's much easier to be precise with chemical fertilizers than it is with organic nutrient sources, and manure especially.
Right.
So, but great nutrient source, but it does have some challenges from a water quality standpoint.
And when we were talking about no-till as important for building soil organic matter and things, and mostly as a benefit to water quality, there's some tension, right?
Right.
Between using manure as a nutrient source in a no-till system and trade-offs with water quality. And I know in one of the research papers that you have that I've read about some of those trade-offs, you know, that, and I'm going to let you describe it instead of me trying to, you know, explain it, but you know, that there were positives to incorporation and there were positives to surface application. So what have you seen with that in different tillage management and its impact on water quality when you're using a manure source?
Right. Yeah. It's the great challenge right now. And, no-till has so many benefits for soil health, soil quality, for preventing soil erosion, building organic matter. So we like all these things. We use less fuel. So from a standpoint of how much fossil fuel we're using to farm land, we use less. We don't have to pull those big tillage. You don't need the big horsepower tractors to pull tillage implements. So there's just so many advantages to no-till. But as you pointed out, when you apply soluble nutrients on top, so we have a lot of manure in this area, you apply soluble nutrients on top, then when we get surface runoff, two things happen. We can lose nutrients to the atmosphere. Nitrogen, there's nitrogen compounds that go into the atmosphere when they're left on the surface. Ammonia volatilizes. And also then when we get surface runoff, those soluble nutrients on the surface run off. So we're trying to find that spot where we sort of optimize the benefits. And we like to stay in no-till as much as possible, but it may be we need some tillage, especially on sites that are prone to runoff. If we don't do something to get the large nutrient sources off the surface, we're going to have really high losses in runoff. So some tillage, we're going to have a little trade-off in erosion. We use cover crops. Again, cover crops come back in to sort of partly offset some of those problems, but we're going to have to do a little tillage, or we're working on some subsurface application equipment for manure, but it's expensive equipment, it's slow. The way modern agriculture was gone, with less people farming more land, I mean, individuals farming more land, every person's farming more land, they have bigger equipment, they're trying to get across more acres faster. Subsurface application equipment goes against that trend in farming. So easy to do on a few acres, great on research plots, hard to do when you're trying to get across a couple thousand acres. So it's a challenge. It's been working on for a long time, but it's a bit of the no-till manure situation has been a bit of the holy grail with water quality.
And I think one of the questions that comes to my mind when you talk about that is, there's different kinds of tillage, right? It's not, there's everything from moldboard plow to vertical tillage or turbo tillage. So if you're concerned about that and you want to try and incorporate manure, how much is enough? You know, is it enough? Is it a good trade-off, would you say, if you're running a turbo till or vertical tillage, or does it take more than that?
Well, it's kind of a sliding scale. If you do a lot of tillage, you're going to be way more prone to, you're going to bust up your soil, you're going to be hard on your soil, and you're going to be very prone to erosion, but your nutrient losses resulting directly from the manure application are going to be very low.
Okay.
As you do a little less tillage, you knock down erosion, you're easier on your soil, but you get a little, then the signal from the applied manure starts to creep, you can start to see it. So it's really pretty much, it's almost pretty intuitive if you till a little bit. I would say overall, a little bit of incorporation. You mentioned vertical tillage, turbo till is a particular brand name of a vertical tillage equipment, where you do a little incorporation, you move things around a little bit, you get some of the manure in the soil, you get some soil contact, it's a benefit. So, I mean, how far we have to go with this sort of depends on the whole bay restoration effort and how far we can get doing everything. And if we can get from an agricultural standpoint, we'd like to not do full tillage.
Right.
So we'll see where it goes. I mean, one of the things that makes the nutrients from a surface applied manure so damaging is it comes off as a dissolved pea, which is totally plant available. So it's the form of phosphorus and the forms of nitrogen that make algae grow. Whereas when we have erosion, we're moving nutrients, some nutrients, but the nutrients are more bound, they're less bioavailable forms. So there's trade-offs are even more complicated than just total N and total nitrogen and total phosphorus. There's actually trade-offs involved in the forms. So what we found is that, unfortunately, and this is one of the most painful findings, I would say, of the 30 years. And we came into this in the 80s again. It was clear that the dissolved phosphorus was coming out of our no-till systems. much higher than we had expected. And so, yes, we were getting the erosion reductions, but we were actually increasing our dissolved P losses, and in some cases, our total phosphorus losses. So our trade-off is soil quality better, using less fossil fuels, conserving moisture, but we are losing more phosphorus. And it was in a bioavailable form. So, and it's been a challenge ever since. It's something people are grappling with around the whole country. And if it's a place where you have 10 tons of per acre of soil erosion, then it's an easy trade-off. You definitely want to go to no-till because you're losing so much soil. But for us, here on the Eastern Shore, our soil erosion rates are really pretty low as it starts with. So we don't get huge reductions like in some places, like say out in the Midwest, where if they go to no-till, they get these massive savings in soil erosion. We don't have that here. So again, I guess that was a pretty wishy-washy answer, but it's a trade-off.
It's the answer.
It's a sliding scale. Yeah, there's a lot of ifs in that equation, but a little bit of incorporation helps a lot. So, but I don't think the answer is full tillage. I don't think we probably want to go there.
So you said something that made me think of it. That with no-till that we would increase our dissolved phosphorus losses and maybe our total phosphorus losses from land. How do cover crops play into that picture? You know, because I've heard a couple of different things about how cover crops impact phosphorus losses. We usually think of them for nitrogen, but they play into the phosphorus cycle too.
Right. Yeah, they're not, for most of our situations, they're not as important on the phosphorus side as they are on the nitrogen side. As soon as you get into a soil erosion situation where you have a high potential for soil erosion, having that cover crop there in the wintertime is huge for reducing the phosphorus loss associated with soil erosion. Okay, so that's particular phosphorus loss. On the dissolved side, it's a little bit of a wash. Cover crops take some of the soluble P out of the top of the soil, like out of the top inch of the soil. They take soil P levels down a little bit. I mean, if it's a very high soil P setting, their effect is going to be minor. But in a soil that's in a fairly modest soil P range, they take up a little soil P, so they take it out of a water-soluble form. It goes into the plant tissue. But when you kill the cover crop, then you have some soluble P that can come out of the cover crop.
Right.
So we sort of look at, for sites that aren't highly erodible, we look at cover crops sort of as a wash on phosphorus. There's a positive on taking up a little soil P, knocking down soil erosion a little bit, but you get a little signal when you kill any living plant material in a no-till setting. There is a phosphorus signal that comes out of that killed plant. So this is full truth on cover crops is you can get a little enhanced phosphorus loss in the spring when you kill that cover crop. Especially if it's a really high soil P situation where the tissue P levels in the cover crop will be high. So that's, we don't really look at, our big need for cover crops for water quality is for nitrogen. Okay. If you don't have a lot of soil erosion. Again, a lot of ifs in there. So you have to look at your soil type, your situation, and say, okay, this is what we expect here. So I don't want to overpromise, but they're fantastic on nitrate and erosion. But on soluble P, we look at it as pretty much a break-even proposition.
Okay.
That's the data. I shouldn't say we look at it. That's what the data tells us.
Sure.
That's what I'm saying. Okay.
So what kind of research projects are you working on now? What are the next questions that you're trying to answer?
Well, certainly there's a push for other types of cover crops. Right now we're actually doing some work with the national USDA NRCS, which is the National Natural Resource Conservation Service. They have a national modeling program that's a conservation effects assessment program.
Okay.
I think it's called SEEP. So there's an acronym, but it's the SEEP program. So they go around the whole country and try and look at, assess how these conservation efforts are working. And it's used as an assessment program and also a planning where you can say, okay, if we do this, what will the effect be? We're actually working with them on trying to help them bring cover crops into that effort. So we're looking at the radishes because there's been push. Everybody likes there's a radish that's used as a cover crop. There's pluses and minuses. So we're actually comparing rye and radish on the surface runoff part. Not so much the nitrate leaching part, but on the surface runoff part to see how that works. Because there's concerns about the cover crops that winter kill, about the soluble nutrients coming out of those cover crops.
Okay.
So one of the nice things about the cereals is they produce compounds in the spring in terms of the way the plants are built, the lignins and the hemiceluloses. Those are the parts that build soil organic matter. Okay, so I know those are big. Those are big. Those are big plant chemical. I mean, they're really not big words, but they're the part of the plant that doesn't break down easily. So when the cover crop decays, what builds soil organic matter are these parts of the plant structure that don't get totally broken down. So that's what builds soil organic matter. So the cereals are great at producing that in the spring, whereas some of these other cover crops, the clovers. Certainly the radishes, they do not produce those kinds of materials. So there's some interest in the soil quality part about whether or not, I think the cereals, I don't mean to be a big always saying, oh, the cereals are the best, but for a lot of things, they really do have some benefits. So that's some of the work now. And then the other issue is about how soil phosphorus plays into the role of cover crops and whether or not, and this issue of how they respond on different soil P levels. And the amount of phosphorus that's actually in the cover crop tissue as an effect of as a result of soil P status. Because of our animal operations here and the manure use, we have a lot of high soil P situations. So just trying to, again, fine-tune how we manage our cover crop, our tillage, our manure applications, sort of a systems-level approach to the problem. Because none of these things work totally in isolation. They all work. You can't do one thing and say, oh, it just affects this. No, it affects everything. So right. We're sort of looking at that total effects level. Just really trying to develop a crop production system that's as you know, productive and as clean as we can get it. So, and all these things are tools that we have in there. So I think that's probably what we're working on the most is the whole package.
Agroecology.
That's it. It's a new, I mean, how else would you do it?
Right. True. So is there anything that you wanted to add that we didn't get to as far as what people need to know? Is there a practice you would recommend across the board? I think we know it, but
well, I mean, cover crops are just one of those things that there's lots of efforts to sort of fine tune the use of cover crops in terms of, well, if it's a dry year, if it was a drought, we're always sort of trying to prioritize. And it's great. It's good in theory, but really what I think the real goal should be just try and find ways to get cover crops planted all the time. Plant them all the time, as you know, any way possible, get them planted. So, yes, certain situations, they work better than others. Some situations, they don't maybe do so much in a particular year, but just try and have it be part of the operation. Plant them early and let them grow as long as you can. In the spring, work on management approaches that towards getting them to let them grow as long as possible to keep those soil nitrate levels down. Produce, you know, take some more carbon out of the atmosphere, save a little more moisture, suppress the weeds. So those two things, I guess, plant them all the time, plant them early. Kill them late. So I guess, and the other message would be to the folks that aren't in the production business, the consumer community, I guess, is that, you know, you got to support these efforts because there's just really not a way. A lot of this water quality benefits, there's really not a way for a farmer to recapture the costs when they sell the product. I mean, corn, the grain prices are what they are. You don't get more. If you're a fantastic steward of the land, you do not get more for your corn than if you're not. So you really, I think the public willingness to support these efforts is a basically a way for them to have their food be as clean as possible. So I guess that's right. I guess that's where I'll leave it.
Well, Ken, it sounds like you live in a world of variables, and we appreciate you taking time out of your day and
thank you talking very with much. Us.
Yep. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to put out, you know, the hard-earned little information we have to put it out there. So
great.
Great to be here.
All right, guys. Until next time.